This is KNX In Depth, an outreach day when we dig deeper, ask more questions, and tell you how the major stories of the day impact you. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Chris Seatons, and today for Mike Simpson.
Who needs judges and who needs courts? So annoying when you just want things done pronto, right away, like today. Only in this country, courts and judges play a big role in lots of stuff. But President Trump does not want them to play a role anymore when it comes to immigrants crossing the U.S. border illegally. Just wants to send them packing. So we will go in depth to ask, can he do this? Also, the attack on civility, a White House spokeswoman kicked out of an upscale eatery, and a congresswoman urging people to seek out and protest Trump officials who are out in public.
Also on today's show, it is an American icon, Harley Davidson, but now it says it will make some of its motorcycles overseas. A victim of the tariff wars now raging between the United States and just about everybody, and domestic abuse using the so-called Internet of Things, home appliance is being used as weapons. We will go in depth on that as well. We'll also tell you about a very unusual call to 911 from a Canadian boy.
We begin with the president's comments that people who seek asylum in the United States do not need to see a judge.
We want a system where when people come in illegally, they have to go out.
With us now is John Hsu, constitutional law attorney in Orange County. John, the president says, you know, it would take thousands of judges. We just can't do it. Send them packing. Can you do it?
Well, to some degree, it already exists. In 1996, President Clinton created something called expedited removal. And that's a process where immigration officers on the ground can immediately deport certain non-citizens who either are improperly documented or have committed some kind of fraud or representation. And the area that that incorporates originally was anywhere within 100 miles of either the Mexican border or the Canadian border. So in a way, when President Trump is saying to skip the judges, that's existed for over 20 years. And then also for illegal migrants who are trying to come through the border, generally speaking, they're not automatically entitled to a judicial hearing. And for those who are claiming asylum, if they claim asylum at a U.S. consulate, a U.S. embassy, or at a port of entry, they don't need a judge because they're being processed right away. And their asylum claims are being processed right away. The only time that they would need a judge is if those asylum claimants are found to be fraudulent or lying or caught trying to smuggle drugs or other contraband in. And then at that point, if they wish to contest that, then they are entitled to a judge. So it's really a very, very small percentage of cases where legally, according to the letter of the law, that illegal entrants are permitted and entitled to an automatic hearing.
Yeah, it was my impression that, I mean, the reason for these judges is to decide whether or not somebody has a reasonable claim that they are seeking asylum. And in many cases, we don't know until they meet with the judge, correct?
Well, that's not always true. For example, there are many people who try to cross either the border or points of entry many times. Sometimes they use fraudulent names, but you know, when they do a fingerprint check or a handwriting check or whatever, they see that it's the same person just using different names, or sometimes they claim to be coming from different countries. And in that respect, obviously they're being fraudulent, and then they are not entitled to an automatic hearing. The consular official or the Border Patrol official or the ICE Immigrations and Custom Enforcement official, they have the authority to turn them away right immediately.
But John, has this been tested though in the Supreme Court? Has the U.S. Supreme Court yet ruled on whether or not this particular, as you put it, the letter of the law, it turns out to be constitutional or not?
No, it's never been challenged. It's never been challenged even at the lower court, let alone the Supreme Court. And the fact of the matter is that this expedited removal process has been in existence since the Clinton administration in 1996. I would note for all of our listeners that the amount of expedited removals was pretty stable between the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush 43 administration. But under President Obama, starting around 2010, the number just skyrocketed from a little less than 100,000 expedited removals to almost 198, almost 200,000 expedited removals under President Obama. So the fact of the matter is that the expedited removals, which do not require an immigration judge, sharply increased under President Obama, and it's really not a surprise that President Trump would continue the policies of his many predecessors, including Obama and Clinton, both Democrat presidents.
Well, John, before we let you go, maybe further to Charles' question about the Supreme Court, is that where this could eventually be headed?
Well, it, certainly somebody could challenge an expedited removal, although the Supreme Court in the past has held that Fourth Amendment and to a lesser extent Fifth Amendment rights are somewhat truncated at a border or an airport or some other point of entry, the fact of the matter is that they do still exist. So there's nothing preventing them from challenging it. I would say that, generally speaking, the Democrats who are against President Trump are also very much in favor of what we call in the law the administrative state, or agencies like Immigration and Customs Enforcement or the Border Patrol or whatever. And in that respect, it would be interesting to see them side with conservative academics in saying that the administrative state is much too powerful on its own, and that our elected officials, our congressmen, and so on and so forth, yeah, need to be more accountable to the people,
right,
rather than some faceless bureaucrat at the border.
All right, John Hsu, constitutional law attorney in Orange County.
Please, thank you. I beg to differ with you. So nice. But when KNX in Depth continues, the reality, the end of civility in politics. You're listening to KNX in Depth with Chris Sedens. I'm Charles Feldman.
As we continue our discussion, a reminder that coming up after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking about why Harley Davidson will be making some of its iconic American motorcycles in Europe, and then domestic abusers using technology to frighten their victims.
Remember when people would say things like please and thank you, and if they objected to something, they'd say, I beg to differ with you. Well, what is happening in this country now? White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders brought it all up during her media briefing.
Many by now have heard that I was asked to leave a restaurant this weekend where I attempted to have dinner with my family. My husband and I politely left and went home. I was asked to leave because I work for President Trump. We are allowed to disagree, but we should be able to do so freely and without fear of harm. And this goes for all people, regardless of politics. Some have chosen to push hate and vandalism against the restaurant that I was asked to leave from. A Hollywood actor publicly encouraged people to kidnap my children. And this weekend, a member of Congress called for people to push back and make clear to those serving their country in this administration that they are not welcome anywhere, anytime, for anything. Healthy debate on ideas and political philosophy is important. But the calls for harassment and push for any Trump supporter to avoid the public is unacceptable. America is a great country, and our ability to find solutions despite those disagreements is what makes us unique.
And Sarah Sanders is speaking with the media today. With us now is a co-author of Politico's playbook, Daniel Lipman. Daniel, no matter what people think of Sarah Sanders, You have to believe that she's absolutely right in this case. Healthy debate is important. It can be tough debate, but harassment is really way beyond the line.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to live in a society where people with an opposing political opinion are just not allowed in restaurants or go to movie theaters. You know, that makes it almost like America's in a civil war. That's what I was talking to, you know, some historians like Michael Beschloss. He said, you know, some of the huge divisions in our society kind of reminds him of what happened before the Civil War. And so, you know, you don't have to like President Trump, or you can really hate him, but people who work for him, you know, you can disagree with them peacefully without having to throw them out of restaurants.
Well, let me ask you this sort of contrarian point of view, because you kind of hinted at that. You know, historically, this country has been a kind of rough and tumble place. And if you go back through the historical record, certainly after the Revolutionary War and, you know, the 1800s, I mean, the politics in this country was pretty down and dirty. People were calling each other names, including presidential candidates. There were all kinds of vicious literature out there attacking political parties. One might suggest that that period in between, when things were rather civil, may have been a period of when people were just kind of being phony about it.
Yeah, although America, you know, has long had like political disagreements without it being, you know, too personal. And so just because we have that history does not mean that we should not try to make a better country and not argue with our opponents politically in terms of making them feel unwelcome in society, because that's not the way to change their minds if you want to. And, you know, no one is saying that people should not protest, but it's also the case that, you know, Sanders, you know, this is not the first time, and it's happened to people like her, Stephen Miller and Kirstjen Nielsen. They were accosted at Mexican restaurants. Pam Bondi, the Florida Attorney General, she was basically followed at a movie theater when she was seeing the new film about Mr. Rogers. And so it's kind of a unique moment in our country where people who whose candidate, Hillary Clinton, lost a couple of years ago, they are kind of lashing out against people who they see as agents of inhumane and unethical policies from the Trump administration.
Well, you know, arguments at restaurants, people from the White House being kicked out of restaurants, you know, that's one thing. Tell me, in your reporting, you're dealing with the people in the nation's capital. Do you ever hear any concern about it going a step further, about it leading to violence?
I don't think it's going to lead to violence. But, you know, the more these types of things happen, the higher the chances of that. I wrote a magazine story last week about what life is like in Washington for young people who work in the Trump administration. And we call it the young Trumpies in D.C. And many of them have trouble finding dates. They have lost a lot of friends who are liberal. They all cocoon themselves in one part of town to avoid the anti-Trump parts. And so it's just interesting to see, to talk to people who are working for the White House, who some of them get yelled at when leaving work.
How much are the media to blame for all this? I mean, let's face it, it's a lot more exciting for TV and for radio to have people really going at one another's throats than to have a civil discussion.
It is, but usually the media reflects what's happening in society right now. So we can't in the media just ignore when posts on Twitter and Facebook go viral about Sarah Sanders and other Trump people. And so people want to know. And so there's a responsibility factor in the media as well. And maybe by sharing some of these stories about what's going on, then you kind of try to have a movement that would reverse it. And so go back to being more polite and, you know, listening to the better angels of our nature instead of getting so rough and tumble that we're basically going to become two countries.
Daniel Lipman, co-author of Politico's Playbook.
Now, if I say etiquette, you probably think things like, you know, don't speak with a mouth full of food, right? Things like that. But when KNX In Depth continues, we will speak with an expert on a different kind of etiquette, the etiquette about the new boundaries of political civility.
You're listening to KNX In Depth along with Charles Feldman. I'm Chris Sedens.
And a reminder that after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, every war has its casualties. The tariff war's no different. Harley Davidson. And then domestic abusers are using household appliances and the internet to terrorize their victims.
Right now, though, we want to talk a bit more about civility in politics and in this country as a whole. With us now is corporate etiquette expert Rachel Isgar. Rachel, we talked in our last segment about people being kicked out of restaurants, a Congresswoman, Maxine Waters, urging people to protest whenever they see administration officials out in public. What should people do if they're dissatisfied? And again, we don't want to see violence. How do you politely show your disagreement?
First of all, thank you so much for having me on the air today. And this etiquette around social media and Twitter and being able to voice our opinions is really very gray. There's not much written on what is okay and, you know, what's not okay to do. But we are very lucky that we live in a country where you can be passionate and you can have a loud voice. You know, the sides, the issues, they change every week. But there's a whole lot to being polite, being gracious, saying thank you, and also making your opinion known. You know, a Twitter storm is fine. It's okay to debate the issues, but you want to make sure that you do that with civility.
Well, when does debating the issues, especially on social media like Twitter, when does that cross the line and become just plain old bullying?
Well, it's how you say things, and people really need to think a little bit before posting, not acting in rage, so it doesn't lead to violence or other negative outcomes. There's wonderful ways that if you put a little bit of thought into what you say, even in a Twitter storm, that you can make progress and you can have engagement, because engaging is very important and communicating.
You know, with what we've seen so far, is there a concern? Do you have a concern that there is a bit of a fine line between shouting somebody down at a restaurant and someone who may take things too far and resort to violence?
You know, we need to prevent that by using our outlets to vent, but doing that within boundaries, because you never want to lead to any violence. You need to listen to the other side. You know, both sides will have a voice. Having a loud voice doesn't necessarily mean it's the only voice. But finding a way to engage politely in these forums is huge, and you know, something as Americans that we're used to doing.
But a lot of people say, and in terms of etiquette, excuse me, a lot of people, you know, say that this lack of civility, the tone is often set at the very top. So, if you were at the White House tomorrow morning, you had a chance to sit down and talk with President Trump, would you give him some etiquette advice, and what would that be?
If I was going to talk with President Trump, I mean, he is a master of knowing how to use Twitter, but I would want to say, take a deep breath. Don't post or vent something in rage. Take a minute. Think about how other people feel when they hear this, you know, and be gracious. And he is very often when he's talking to people. But it's collecting yourself and engaging, but being calm when you do that.
All right. Corporate etiquette expert Rachel Isgar.
KNX In-Depth continues in just about 4 minutes. Oh, a casualty of the tariff war. Harley Davidson, an American icon, will tell you all about that. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Chris Edens in for Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Felder.
We want to turn our attention now to the trade war between the United States and other countries. The latest iconic American motorcycle maker, Harley Davidson, says it plans to move some of its manufacturing to Europe so that motorcycles that are purchased over there will be made there.
So joining us now is James Hardiman, equity research analyst with Wedbush Securities. James, the president promised when he was running for office more jobs for Americans, more business for America, America first, all that. And now you've got Harley Davidson saying, we've got no choice because of these tariff wars. We're going to move some of our production overseas. This isn't the way it was supposed to be.
That's correct. It's almost as if there are unintended consequences of trade wars. I say facetiously to some degree. Yes, the Trump economy thus far hasn't been very good for Harley Davidson. This actually isn't even the first of it. I mean, they announced a few months ago that the results of some of the steel and aluminum tariffs was going to impact their business to the tune of about $15 million. And that was 3 months ago. So it's a good chance that's potentially doubled. And then today's news, I think, suggests that, it's going to be difficult for Harley, who is not the dominant player in Europe the way they are here in the United States, to compete if they were to announce a significant price hike. And so as a result, they're going to have to produce elsewhere, which is, ultimately, I think Harley Davidson will survive all of this, and it'll take a couple years before they're able to to offset some of this. But I think the workers that are in a position where they might temporarily, or I shouldn't say temporarily, eventually get laid off, it's going to be a lot harder for them to recover.
Can we expect the president to get some pushback on this, the fact that he said the tariffs are meant to try to protect American jobs? And right now we're seeing the exact opposite effect. Harley-Davidson now being forced to, what, close down manufacturing here and move jobs to Europe?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that there will be pushback. I think a lot of manufacturers that I follow, but more broadly, that do business around the world have been against the nationalistic trade policy that's been a central tenet of his campaign. And whether or not he'll listen to any of those people, I mean, look, when Harley-Davidson's management famously went and visited the White House in the first couple of weeks of the Trump presidency, I think one of the discussions was trade, and they were big proponents of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which they thought was a big opportunity for them to make inroads into Asia. Obviously, they didn't get that, and now we're seeing that you know their single biggest international market, Europe, is in jeopardy as well.
We should point out, by the way, that we did ask the union that represents Harley-Davidson workers to come on the air with us. They sent instead a statement. It says, in part, that it is the latest slap in the face to the company's workers. So, James, this isn't going to be the first company, is it? I mean, as these trade wars intensify with the European Union, with China, we're going to see many more American companies having to make the same grim choice that Harley-Davidson had to face, aren't we?
I think that's 100% right. Although, having said that, I guess I would argue that an awful lot of these companies have already made that choice years, if not decades ago in some instances. Harley was in, I believe, it was a precarious situation, but they were boxed in because their customers, probably more than any customer group that I can think of, would revolt if Harleys were made overseas. Now, to be clear, I don't think that any of the bikes sold here are going to be made anywhere else but here. But the perception of Harley, the negative PR consequences of moving production is probably greater than most companies. These guys, after all, essentially sell Americana. And so as I think about some of the companies that I follow, most of them have already moved some manufacturing to other parts of the world. Harley was just further behind, just given who they are and what they sell.
Let's talk a little bit about the uncertainty of all this. We see President Trump come into office and overturn a number of Obama-era laws. What's to stop, say we have a change in government 2.5 years, maybe 6.5 years from now, depending on who comes into office. What I'm getting at is overturning Trump-era laws on tariffs. Will all these companies then be forced to move back?
Well, I don't think they're going to be forced to move back, because I think in the case of at least Harley-Davidson, it's probably going to be more profitable for them to make these bikes elsewhere. I think that they haven't had a real good excuse to do it thus far, but I think this is an awfully good one. And even if the Democrats come back into power and reverse the tariffs, like so many other industries, I don't know if those jobs are ever going to come back.
James Hardiman, equity research analyst with Wedbush Securities.
Now, it is called the Internet of Things. Everything connected, your refrigerator, your television, your toaster, really cool stuff. That is until they become weapons of domestic abuse. That when KNX In Depth continues.
You're listening to KNX In Depth along with Charles Feldman. I'm Chris Sedens.
Well, domestic abuse has taken a new turn. Abusers are using smartphone technology, turning lights on, turning lights off, adjusting the thermostat, changing computerized door locks, and a lot more in the homes of their victims. So with us now is Ian Harris, Technology Safety Legal Manager at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. Ian, for those who are not that tech savvy, can you explain exactly how someone's refrigerator, toaster, and perhaps garage door can end up being weapons of domestic abuse?
Sure. Thank you for having me. I know it sounds a little bit like something from a scary sci-fi movie, but it is true that more and more devices around the home have internet connections. And so when we're talking about smart home technology, what we're essentially talking about is how a device like a refrigerator or a thermostat can be connected to the internet to allow somebody to ostensibly control it from any place that they have an internet connection, which of course can be used for good reasons, but also has the potential for misuse.
Okay, so it sounds like that if somebody wants to get back at their ex and they know how to control their refrigerator or the heat in the house or the front door or whatever, they could really kind of try and make things unpleasant. Are you concerned that this potentially could be used in a dangerous, very dangerous way?
Yeah, and you know, I think we're actually seeing an increase of calls to our hotlines and helplines, and we're also talking to service providers, attorneys, and social workers throughout the country who are saying this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue in domestic violence cases. I do think that there is a dangerous component here, both emotionally and otherwise. So smart home devices nowadays have the ability to allow someone to listen, to see what's happening in the home remotely. They also have the ability to let somebody turn something on or off. If somebody has been in a relationship, either in the past or currently in a relationship, it's not uncommon for people to share access to that device. And so the ability to turn things on and off at inopportune times, the ability to see what's happening, can, of course, be used to surveil, to harass, to stalk many of the things that we see outside in other contexts of domestic violence, but it's now given a whole new tool for this type of misuse.
Well, for some things, but I'm wondering if the law has caught up with a lot of this technology, as it often doesn't. I mean, if you know, a couple split and the you know, one party decides to use the smartphone to make sure that the other party's toast doesn't come out quite as dark as they perhaps wanted it to be, there's a law against that?
So, you know, I think when you're talking about the law, I think you have two major questions there. So there's two major categories of threats to consider. So there's an external threat and there's an internal threat. Now, the external threat is things like hackers and selling of data. The internal threat is more like what we've discussed today, which is around the issues of, you know, a partner or an ex-partner using this information. In terms of whether the law has caught up to that internal threat, you know, in some ways it has, and in some ways it hasn't. So there are stalking laws, there are harassment laws throughout the country that may be able to be applied in this context, but really, you know, as a person who's litigated a lot of domestic violence cases myself, I know that it can be very difficult to prove those things, even if there is a law in place. So many jurisdictions aren't going to have actual laws that specifically deal with the issue of smart home technologies, though they may have existing laws like harassment and stalking that may be applicable, but always in domestic violence cases, there's the difficulty of proving the case that we still have to deal with. So I think we still need better laws, and we also need better ways to prove it.
You talk about laws having to catch up with technology. It seems like we've got new technology every year. There's something new coming. Is this a problem that is likely to get even worse in the years to come?
I do think that we need to come up with solutions on a broader scale to think about how we're going to protect our information. And that of course has a particularly acute issue when we're talking about domestic violence issues. But I think there's a broader conversation just as a society about how we're going to regulate the fact that we put so much information into our technology. Now, I can tell you lots of examples of ways that technology is misused, but I do also want to note that there are lots of ways that technology can be used in positive ways to help increase people's safety. I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but I do think if we don't start thinking more seriously about cybersecurity, we all have a pretty big issue on our hands.
Ian Harris, Technology Safety Legal Manager at the National Network to End Domestic Violence.
You know, Chris, it's one of those things, and we've addressed this topic a number of times on this program, that, you know, there's all this new technology out there, and people, they think it's really cool that they've got toasters that connect to the refrigerator,
right,
you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that there is some significant downsides. Hacking, or now it turns out domestic abuse. Who would have thought?
Exactly. I mean, and as we were just talking about now, I mean, this is going to continue year after year after year. What we think is really hot and the newest thing now is going to be old news 3 years from now.
When KNX In-Depth continues in 4 minutes, some of the stories you may have missed, but we did not. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Chris Edens. I'm Charles Feldman.
Oh, mosquitoes. I hate mosquitoes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I got it. Yeah.
Bill Gates reportedly wants to help create mosquitoes that will kill other mosquitoes, and they'll do it through sex. The Microsoft founder is funding a project that would genetically modify male mosquitoes to deliver a gene to females during the mating process to kill off baby mosquitoes. It's to help get rid of malaria, which is transmitted by infected mosquitoes.
Okay, a kid in Halifax, Nova Scotia, no, not you, Chris, doesn't like...
I'm a Winnipegger. Yeah,
okay. Well, this kid doesn't like salad. I mean, he really doesn't like salad. So what does he do? Well, what else? He calls 911. First call, the 12-year-old boy tells the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that he just does not like the salad given him by his guardian. And yes, he did call 911 a second time to find out what was keeping the cops from showing up. Well, the police eventually did show up, only to give the kid a dressing down.
A dressing down. Ba-dum-boom.
Bring back the mosquito.
Exactly. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Chris Stevens. Thanks for joining us. In Depth returns tomorrow at 1 o'clock. CBS News is next.